This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Coming up. So you don't think 2 degrees is really safe?
I think 2 degrees is too much. It's a world without tropical coral reefs. It's a world without coniferous forests in western North America. It's a world probably with dieback and the southern and eastern Amazon and a whole bunch of other things that we actually can't even sort of foresee.
Dr. Thomas Lovejoy, who introduced the term biodiversity, who advises presidents and the World Bank, visits Radio EcoShock. Next, we wrestle with science and spirituality. Do we need them both? Dr. Carolyn Baker is back. She taught history and psychology. She was a psychotherapist in private practice. Now she advises us all about going positive in a negative world.
But what really matters is coming to a place of finding meaning in all of this, finding one's life purpose, deciding what one is going to do with the time one has left. Am I just going to shrivel up and crawl in a hole and do myself in? Or am I going to use these experiences and these events as an opportunity to give the gifts that I came here with and to make a difference in my little world, even if I can't make a difference in the big world? That we all have something to give. We all have something to contribute. And it really, I believe, is our obligation to find out what that is and do it.
Plus, Alex rants about the big balloon of debt poised right up against the knife edge of millions of people in poverty. In America, Canada, the UK, and Australia, countless people can't even come up with $500, just 300 pounds. Maybe that's you, or someone you know. What happened to the middle-class dream? It's Radio EcoShock, Living on the Edge.
There's a kind of nagging suspicion that there's something fundamentally wrong with human culture. Maybe we've been holed up in cities for too long and this is the cause of our unease. Or maybe the cult of consumerism has had its day and we're looking for a new set of values and aspirations. Or maybe it's simply that modern science and religion have failed to imbue our lives with real meaning. Maybe, though, the root cause of our ills lies in our relationship to nature. And by nature, I mean the biosphere in which we're embedded.
This is Radio EcoShock.
Introducing our next guest on Radio EcoShock is a bit of a problem. It can take 5 minutes to list out his posts, awards, and credentials, and his time is too valuable, so I'll spare you some of that. Back in 1980, Dr. Thomas E. Lovejoy introduced the term biological diversity to the world. He's currently a professor at George Mason University and the biodiversity chair at the Heinz Center. Dr. Lovejoy has advised the United Nations, the World Bank, and 3 past presidents. Beyond that, though, he's a tireless advocate for endangered ecosystems that have no voice of their own. Dr. Thomas Lovejoy, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
Well, Thomas, it seems the environment community and the public are tightly focused on fossil fuels as the threat to the world climate. But in this fight against coal and oil, we may be missing another huge cause of climate change. Can you talk to us about that?
So it actually cuts both ways. I mean, climate change has really devastating consequences for biological diversity. But also in the biology of the planet is a partial solution to the climate change challenge we've set up for ourselves. And the little known fact is that a major portion of current excess CO2 actually comes from 3 centuries of ecosystem destruction and degradation. And it would be possible through ecosystem restoration, if done at planetary scale, to actually take back about 0.5 degree worth of potential global warming. So there's some good news built into all of this.
So what are we talking about? Are we talking about forests disappearing or what?
So in terms of how that excess CO2 arrived in the atmosphere, it's from deforestation and It's from essentially degrading grasslands and grazing lands. It's from forms of agriculture which leak carbon as opposed to retain it, or in fact, ideally build it up because it relates to soil fertility. So it's all about ways we have used terrestrial ecosystems, and there probably is a companion piece to that in marine systems, maybe not as much, but in terms of mangroves which have been destroyed and coastal wetlands and the like.
Yes, we have almost a club of people who are constantly pointing out the huge amount of carbon that we've lost through agriculture. It's just sort of disappearing out of the soil and up into the atmosphere.
That's right, and taking the associated fertility with it.
You've warned as climate changes, whole ecosystems don't move together, individual species move. Why is that important?
Because at a certain point, instead of sort of the mild little ripples of change that we're mostly seeing these days, although there's some really major ones, that you'll get to a point where each of these species will be moving in different directions and at different rates, and the ecosystems that we know will disassemble, and then whatever species manage to survive will reassemble into ecosystems that are really hard to envision in advance and certainly to manage for.
Well, you are known, Thomas Lovejoy, for your work on the Amazon, but I want to ask you about an area of the world that's less talked about, namely the African savanna. What is happening there? What are the challenges?
The African savanna, shockingly, is now down to about 30% in intact form. So all those great animals of the African savannas are all, in one degree or another, endangered in the process. And as agriculture advances in Africa and the population grows there, which it is certain to do, there will only be more pressure to take more of the savanna unless we essentially address it squarely and come up with better forms of agriculture that are more productive without leaking that soil carbon.
Well, and what about, for example, China, I'm told, is buying up a lot of farmland there to export food back to their own country, and then you have the mining. There's a lot of things going on there that we have to watch out for.
Well, that's precisely the case. So it's not only agriculture and the needs of a growing population, or shall I say not particularly productive agriculture and the needs of a growing population, but it's also the interest in the natural resources of Africa that is being acted on by acquisition of major pieces of territory.
Would you allow me one tough question? I have to be frank, some of our listeners may distrust a person who has advised the United Nations or the World Bank, and even George Mason University was a little bit tarnished by the Wegman Report controversy, yet I still hear you trying as an activist, a real environmentalist. How do you personally survive the inertia of these big institutions and even the conferences that you attend that don't have a great record of stopping the destruction of the living world?
So they're essentially two answers to that. I mean, one is, in fact, those institutions are changing. And in fact, I had an hour with the president of the World Bank, essentially one-on-one on Friday, talking about biodiversity and climate change. And I can assure you that he gets this really seriously. We have a new president, George Mason, who's the world leader in sustainability for business and management schools. So a partial answer is the institutions themselves are changing. Is it all at scale yet? No. And the one thing you can guarantee is that if you don't keep trying, it will all turn out to be as awful as you thought it might be. So you just really have to keep going at it. And I did, in fact, on the 22nd of January, write a pretty strong opinion piece which ran in the Herald Tribune to the effect that, you know, this is not about business as usual. That, in fact, the kinds of things that people discuss at meetings like Davos will, in retrospect, seem trivial compared to these big, overwhelming environmental vectors.
Right. I talked to Dr. Paul Ehrlich a couple of weeks ago. He's published a paper in the Royal Society saying that the chances of the collapse of the industrial system are quite high. And he said, well, look, maybe there's only a 10% chance that we're going to get out of this in a good shape, but I'm going to keep working to make it 11%. Is that sort of your feeling on that?
Well, absolutely. I mean, if you don't work to change it for the better, it all becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with the eminent spokesman for living things, Dr. Thomas Lovejoy. Thomas, just out in the news, Bolivia is preparing to pass legislation that would give Mother Earth, actually Mother Nature, rights equal to human rights. What do you think about that?
So, in fact, they are not the first. Ecuador has a constitution that gives nature basic rights. You know, as a recognition in principle of the importance of the natural world in its own right, and also as, in the end, the fundamental resources in support of humanity, it's a smart thing to do.
Well, you know, this is something that frustrates me, even on my own program. When I talk to some good people, say, about the rainforest, they'll say, well, there may be some useful medicines or chemicals waiting for us out there, but I think these wonderful plants and creatures have a right to exist, just as we do. Is that your feeling?
I certainly think there is a strong moral and ethical argument that all our fellow plants and animals and other organisms with whom we share a 4 billion year common history and common ancestry need to be treated with the kind of respect we're just talking about.
Well, how can we do it? How can we get that out to the public that nature's not just a product to be used?
I think probably the most important thing is just to give young people a chance to experience the natural world, to taste its and view its wonders firsthand. And it's hard to forget that once you've had that interaction.
Well, we're going to have to make that into an app for an iPhone to do it, because that's where a lot of people are.
Here's the interesting thing. You know, I mean, I always have been a great believer in harnessing technology to do good for the environment, which is why I started the Nature series on public television 30-plus years ago. And now it turns out that John Kress at the Natural History Museum at the Smithsonian has produced an app called Leaf Snap, which basically you can go up to any tree in the mid-Atlantic or eastern United States, photograph a leaf. It will take 55 measurements and tell you what species it is.
I could have used that when I was sort of in the back to the land movement, because I moved up there and didn't know the trees by their bark, and that's what you need in the wintertime when there aren't any leaves, so you've got to recognize that to know what the good firewood is. So we have a lot to learn as city people.
That's right. Well, I'm sure that, you know, the next version of Leaf Snap will also allow you to identify trees from buds and things like that.
Well, getting back to the climate, you warn that it may not come gradually like the sloping curve on the graphs we've seen. What could happen?
I think the capacity of the climate system to have abrupt change is very real, and we know that's happened in the past. We also are already seeing abrupt change in ecosystems. For example, when tropical coral reefs have bleaching events, and basically, you know, the whole technicolor world becomes black and white, and the productivity and diversity crash, and the benefit to local populations crash. So that's why I'm so concerned about trying to keep climate change below 1.5 degrees.
So you don't think 2 degrees is really safe?
I think 2 degrees is too much. It's a world without tropical coral reefs. It's a world without coniferous forests in western North America. It's a world probably with dieback in the southern and eastern Amazon, and a whole bunch of other things that we actually can't even sort of foresee.
Would you care to get specific about a couple of species that you love but fear may become extinct?
I would flag two groups of species generally. One that live in high places, like pika in the southern Rockies, which live at high altitudes and will be tracking their changing climate by moving upward in altitude until suddenly there's no further to go. So there are a whole bunch of high altitude species around the world which are very vulnerable. And similarly, island species are quite vulnerable, especially low-lying island species, because the last time the world was 2 degrees warmer, the oceans were 4 to 6, maybe even 8 meters higher. So that's going to have a huge impact on coasts and coastal populations, and a lot of those low-lying islands and their species will just simply disappear beneath the waves.
Some biologists suggest we're already in the sixth great extinction event. Do you think that's going too far?
You know, personally, I think we can already begin to see the outlines of it, maybe dimly, but yes.
I know a lot of us accept the Earth as a physical system. We were comfortable with it that way, but you've said it's a biophysical system, so why is that important to know?
Well, if you really want to manage how the climate works, you have to take cognizance of the carbon cycle. I mean, the reality is all that excess CO2 is a product of biological activity. Some of it's ancient biological activity in the form of fossil fuels, coal, oil, and gas, and some of it is essentially modern biological activity in terms of the ecosystem destruction of the past centuries. So if you start thinking about the climate as something that is governed both by physical aspects of the planet as well as the biology of the planet, then you're thinking holistically as we struggle with how to manage this challenge.
Well, now, if you had another hour with President Obama, what would you be talking about with him?
I think I would start with 2 degrees is too much. I'm not sure that, you know, his advisors on climate have necessarily highlighted that. You know, and everybody treats it as sort of a number to be respected when, in fact, it's mostly put together by what negotiators thought might be convenient as opposed to what would be good for the planet and for humanity. So that would be point number one. Point number two would be let's pull half a degree out of the atmosphere by engaging in much more restorative approaches to the ecosystems of the planet. And then thirdly, I would talk about the need to have integrated planning, whether you're talking about the Mekong or the Amazon Basin or some portion of the United States, so that in fact you can begin to manage the landscapes and waterscapes of the world in ways which are beneficial and don't essentially end in unintended, unfortunate circumstances.
Thomas Lovejoy, would you give us a glimpse of some of the current projects that you're working on?
So I'm just starting with my co-editor Lee Hanna on a second edition of Climate Change and Biodiversity, because our understanding of that topic has just exploded in the essentially 7 years since it was published. So that's one thing, and I'm still working on Amazon issues and what happens when you break a forest up into fragments. I also chair the science panel for the Global Environment Facility, which is the largest funder of environment projects in the world, at least with public funds. And I don't know, and every time I turn around, I find something more I need to do.
Well, as we wrap up, is there anything else you would like to say or leave us with?
Well, you know, more than anything, I would just say, you know, the more people help others understand both the importance of the living world and the wonders of it, the better we will contribute to our children's and grandchildren's future.
Our guest has been Dr. Thomas Lovejoy. He's one of the fathers of environmental science and a champion of nature. Dr. Lovejoy teaches at George Mason University. He's the biodiversity chair at the H. John Heinz Center for Science, Economics, and the Environment. Lovejoy is an advisor to the Global Environment Facility and much more. Find links to all that in my blog at ecoshock.info. Thomas Lovejoy, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. You can help Radio EcoShock keep going. Make a donation at our website, ecoshock.org. The more rational a culture seems to be, the more irrational will be its underside when the dark times come, the veils lift, and more is revealed than most want to see. Those are the words of Michael Mead in his seminal article, Why the World Doesn't End. It is also the opening quote in another piece called The Really Big Transition, Saying Goodbye to the Enlightenment, Saying Hello to Consciousness. The author is a friend of this program, Carolyn Baker. Actually, that is Dr. Carolyn Baker, a psychotherapist in private practice and former adjunct professor of history and psychology, now living in Colorado. I hear from Carolyn every day through her email update of pithy news about a world in trouble. But at the bottom of that page, Carolyn also sends her solutions links with tips about things you and I can do. She's a thought leader and writer for Transition Colorado. And I promise, whatever dark times we do talk about, we'll get to some of those solutions in the end. I invited Carolyn to Radio EcoShock because I'm wrestling with my own problem, as you listeners may know. Science is telling us humans are in the process of wrecking the world for life as we know it. But very few of us are really responding. We just keep wasting the planet. We pollute the land, the sea, the atmosphere, as though there's no tomorrow, and maybe there won't be. Why is reason failing? As we look for alternatives, how can we avoid the pitfalls of past superstition, not to mention the just plain craziness so prevalent on the internet? So to help us with all that, Carolyn Baker, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Well, it's wonderful to be back. Thank you so much for inviting me.
All right. Well, I want to start at this point. Here on the West Coast, you can go to a retreat to believe anything.
I'm sure. I used to live in California.
And we get to a place that we call the woo-woo factor, and that's the point where people go all glassy-eyed and they're convinced that mysticism will change the world, maybe including car addiction or coal burning in China, I suppose. Is that where you want to take us?
No. You know, mysticism is making a huge return right now in modern culture, actually. If you look at the popularity of some of the mystical poets like Rumi, Kabir, Hafiz, and you just look at the kind of returning popularity of poetry in general, you kind of get a feel for this returning mysticism. And some people equate that with superstition or, you know, this is irrational. How is it going to help us solve any problems? But in fact, you know, the crux of my work is helping us bring together the scientific, the rational, with the mystical, with the beyond rational, I like to call it. Because I think that's where we're going. We're going into an age not of science or of spirituality, but an age of consciousness where the two of those are going to be integrated in a lot of different ways.
Well, it kind of reminds me of that old detective show that used to be on radio. It was somebody who was looking for the facts and nothing but the facts. But that isn't who we are.
Well, it's not only not who we are, it just is no longer appropriate in dealing with the challenges that we are being confronted with right now. You know, I've written in this article that I recently posted and that I sent you, The Really Big Transition, saying goodbye to the Enlightenment, saying hello to consciousness. I wrote in there about the Enlightenment and how it came about in the 17th and 18th centuries, why it was important in human history. But one of the legacies of the Enlightenment was that everything is getting better and better all the time because man is this rational animal who's just improving, improving, improving. And out of that assumption came the Industrial Revolution and this notion of infinite progress and infinite growth. And now we're discovering that that is just, it served a purpose at one point, but it's no longer appropriate because it flies in the face of reality, which is infinite growth is over. And I like to say you can have all the growth you want on the inside in your consciousness. And so, you know, where we're moving right now is, well, what do we do? We're not growing anymore, so what do we do? Well, what we do is we're being compelled to turn inside, not to become irrational, not to reject some of the really important contributions of the Enlightenment, but to go beyond those. And because the Enlightenment and science have their limitations, spirituality has its limitations, and bringing those two together to serve each other is what I like to think of as consciousness. And that's where we're moving right now. And, you know, the psychologist Carl Jung said that any time we increase our consciousness, there's a price to pay. Consciousness is not won, W-O-N, without a great struggle. So we're in that struggle right now. And it's going to be frightening. It's going to be painful, challenging, daunting, enlivening, exciting. There may be even moments of joy and an incredible reunion with ourselves and each other, but it's going to be a mix.
But you do write about the sacred. One of your most famous books is titled Sacred Demise, Walking the Spiritual Path of Industrial Civilization's Collapse. Well, here on Radio EcoShock, I spend most of my time interviewing scientists. How are the sacred and science supposed to get along?
Well, in that article that I just mentioned, recently published and now on my website at carolynbaker.net, I talk about the new cosmology. You know, in 2009, we lost a wonderful philosopher and a man who called himself a geologian, not a theologian, although he was a theologian, Thomas Berry, was a Catholic priest, a PhD in history. And he began to really look at the universe in terms of the universe having a story that human beings needed to understand, because the story of the universe, which he called the great story, and our own personal stories so much intermingle and overlap. So his life experience of developing a conscious relationship with the earth really led him to explore this great story, and he began talking about how we are at the end of the Cenozoic age and now moving into the Ecozoic age, which is going to expand our awareness and our stewardship of the earth. And science actually has given us incredible tools for understanding this great story. One of my favorite people these days is a guy named Brian Swim, who is a mathematical cosmologist living in Northern California. And he's worked a lot very closely on a number of projects with Thomas Berry. And he talks about the powers of the universe. He has this wonderful DVD series called The Powers of the Universe. And the rationale of this is that we've got to understand, he says, what it means to be a human. In other words, knowing our human identity in terms of the planet, because all other identities are secondary. So in the Powers of the Universe series, it explores how these powers also reside within us and how an enhanced consciousness of our intimate relationship with the universe enables us to live these powers in the world. And integrating the great story with our own story is not about navel-gazing, but about deepening and enlivening our relationships with all of the Earth community. And understanding science and how the universe has played out in very scientific and rational terms helps us understand our own story and our place here on this planet.
Even though it makes me nervous, I do have a feeling of the sacred myself. You know, I picture myself walking along a ridge in Appalachia. There's the deer, there's the birds, there's the waters, all the way it works. And then somebody comes along and just blows the whole top off that mountain, or they dig out a large part of Alberta for the tar sands. I find that outrageous, and it's because I do have the sense that there are sacred things on Earth that you can't do that to.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think what you are articulating is an instinctual connection that you feel with the earth, that you're not over here someplace and the earth is over there someplace, but that the stuff of the stars is within your nervous system. The blood, so-called, of the rivers flows in your veins. And, you know, that's just who we are as human beings. We sense our connection with the earth. If we don't, something has really been shut off within us. And so to have that sensitivity, to have that sense of connection, is sometimes very painful, as you talk about. And it's also very inspiring and enlivening and can really infuse us with a passion to protect and preserve what is left of our earth, and to become more of who we are as a result of savoring that connection that we have with the earth.
This is Radio EcoShock with writer, psychotherapist, and teacher Carolyn Baker. Carolyn, I get some emails from listeners or Facebook messages saying things like, I've decided not to have children after hearing your show, or even intimations of suicide. Are we missing the key tools we need to face these awful things like climate change or economic collapse?
Well, I think that we are. Now, in terms of having children, I think there are a number of reasons right now not to have children. you know, I have published on my website recently some pretty daunting information about climate change. And included in that information is a presentation by Guy McPherson and a number of other scientists really recently collected data pretty much in 2011 and 2012 on the rise in temperature of the planet and how it may be that this planet will only be inhabitable for another 30 to 40 years. So, you know, I think people have to look very long and hard and really soul search a great deal about having children. I think that's really important. But suicide, you know, it's like my work is really about helping people come to a place within themselves where they realize that there's something more important even than their own physical survival. That they may not survive all of these daunting challenges and things that may actually bring forth extinction. But what really matters is coming to a place of finding meaning in all of this, finding one's life purpose, deciding what one is going to do with the time one has left. Am I just going to shrivel up and crawl in a hole and do myself in? Or am I going to use these experiences and these events as an opportunity to give the gifts that I came here with and to make a difference in my little world, even if I can't make a difference in the big world? That we all have something to give. We all have something to contribute. And it really, I believe, is our obligation to find out what that is and do it.
Well, the strange thing is, most of the time, I am happier discovering the truth, even if it is harsh, and I also make a point of looking for joy every day, and it is there, and it pops out at you when you don't expect it, and then I treasure it, and I kind of feed off of that, and that's what helps keep me going.
Absolutely. There's a wonderful website called Radical Joy for Tough Times. You can just Google it. Trebby Johnson is the woman's name who manages the website, Radical Joy for Hard Times. You know, it's like, I love that website because it really, I think, encourages us to look for places of joy in our lives. And no matter how bleak things are, there are places of joy in our lives, and they may be very simple, and we may have to do some looking, but they are there. And, you know, I find that working together in community with people to prepare, you know, starting projects together, building community together. In my case, I'm part of a heart and soul group here in Boulder, Colorado, and there are many heart and soul groups around the world where we get together and we talk about these things in terms of emotional and spiritual preparation. All of those things bring joy, as well as creating beauty on a daily basis, finding beauty in one's life, whether it be through art, music, poetry, theater. All of these can enliven us and bring us more passion and more joy and more juice in our lives.
Well, I've got to agree with that. But getting back, I guess, to the dark side, a few weeks ago I interviewed Dr. Paul Ehrlich. He just published a scientifically reviewed paper in the Royal Society asking whether we can avoid a collapse of industrial civilization. Well, the scientists are a little late to that party. When did you start to see we had problems that have no rational solutions?
Well, my journey on this kind of began back in 2000 when I met Mike Rupert, and I began to subscribe to From the Wilderness, the website that he had at that time. I just began to research and ask a lot of questions. You know, I would say from about 2000 to 2007, I was looking at these challenges and kind of seeing them individually as different dots, you know, that were out there that we have to contend with. But in 2007, I saw a magnificent documentary, which I'm sure many listeners have seen, What a Way to Go, Life at the End of Empire. And that, for me, began to connect all of these dots so that I was able to then begin to name what was happening, which is the collapse of industrial civilization and the paradigm on which it's built. So at that point, you know, I thought, well, you know, this could be pretty depressing stuff unless we have some reason to go through this, unless we have some reason to, unless we can find some meaning in this process. And that's when I began to make notes that eventually became my book, Sacred Demise, Walking the Spiritual Path of Industrial Civilization's Collapse. And then I took that a couple of steps further in 2011 with the publication of Navigating the Coming Chaos, a handbook for inner transition.
All right. Well, just before we get to some of the positive solutions I have found in your daily newsletter, let's get to the nitty-gritty. What kind of spirituality are you proposing?
I am not proposing any particular kind of spirituality. I think everyone needs to find his or her own path. But I think a spirituality that is based on earth wisdom, that deeply connects with the earth and our place in it, is very, very important. And, you know, a person might say, well, spirituality, I don't know what that is. I'm an atheist or I'm an agnostic. Well, it really is just about going out and appreciating the earth, to go out and sit in the dirt and let it sift through your fingers, to taste and smell the earth, to just be very present with the silence around you or the animals around you. That's a spiritual experience because it really encompasses your depths, your soul, your being. So it's not about finding a particular spirituality, but really just being open to that kind of wisdom, that path. Some people find it helpful to study a little bit of the wisdom, great wisdom traditions, Native American spirituality, Buddhism, other paths, and many people like to just kind of integrate all of those. It really is about being open to where you're being guided.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, talking about science and the sacred with Dr. Carolyn Baker. Carolyn, I know you write for the Colorado edition of Transition Times. How is transition going in Colorado?
Well, it's actually going very well. Here in Boulder County, we have a project that is kind of usurping everything else at the moment, called the Local Food Shift. This is a project in which we are trying very hard to get this county to be able to feed itself within a few years. And one of the ways that this is happening is through getting investors to invest in local food, and that is being very successful. We're getting consumers to take a 10% pledge in which they're pledging to spend at least 10% of their food budget on local foods. And so you can go to localfoodshift.com and read more about that. It's a very exciting project, and I'm proud to be part of it.
Well, if someone wants to get involved with Transition Town, the movement in America or anywhere in the world, how do they make that connection?
Transition US. It's just Transition US. That's all one word, transitionus.org.
Good enough. Okay, and I'll put links to that and other transition sites in other countries, how to find it. There's a good map of all that. I'll put that in my blog at ecoshock.info. Let's get to a couple of your favorites, maybe from the many ideas that come up daily, of things that people could do to get started.
Well, the things that I tell people in my life coaching practice, which I'd like to say a little bit about in a moment, is you first of all have to understand you cannot do this alone. When a person first begins to awaken to the magnitude of what we're facing, it can be extremely overwhelming. And, you know, you've had Kathy McMahon on your program and others who've talked about how at first you can feel like you're going crazy. It can be a very schizophrenic kind of feeling. And it's just too overwhelming to be alone with. So I highly recommend that people look around for either a transition group or some other group, or possibly an online forum where you can dialogue with other people about what's going on. You can share your feelings about it. You can engage together in different projects of preparation. I would say that's the first thing. You know, continue to read, watch documentaries, but really, really get involved. And then start looking at your own personal preparation. Where do you live? Is that a place that is likely to sustain you or provide you with maximum sustainability, maximum support in the event that, you know, all of the systems really, really break down and you find yourself being really challenged to find food and water and that sort of thing? It's kind of like there are certain steps and they play out differently for each person, but I say that having a support system of some kind is kind of up there at the top.
That's The Clash, and this is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with author, activist, and teacher Carolyn Baker. Carolyn, I've been agonizing about whether we should move back to the country. Should we stay in the city and fight this beast, or get ready to feed ourselves as the big system collapses? And then finally I realized we should move, and I'm talking about me personally, myself and my wife, we should move, not out of fear, but because we want to. I need to get my hands in the dirt. I need to feel nature around me. I'm hoping to move next year to be happy no matter what the world does. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that's wonderful because what I'm hearing you saying is really that there's something that's calling you, something that's leading or pulling you to a different kind of lifestyle. Just the fact that you say, I want to get my hands in the dirt. Yeah, you could do that perhaps in urban farming in the city, but it sounds like there's something greater, like you have a greater picture of this. And I say to anyone who feels drawn in that direction, by all means, follow the pull.
And you talked about your coaching services. What are you doing there?
Well, I'd like to just clarify one thing. You've called me a psychotherapist, and I used to be a psychotherapist. Currently, I'm not. I do life coaching, however, and the reason for this is that often as we prepare for the future, we find ourselves facing personal or relationship challenges that we need some help moving through. And life coaching is not the same as psychotherapy. Basically, it assumes that all of the answers are already within each person. So my role is to be a catalyst to facilitate the individual in accessing those answers that lie within. And if anyone wants to find out more about it, just simply email me at carolyn@carolynbaker.net.
And what are some of the most common problems that people seek your help for?
I would say the top two problems would be relationships where someone has become awakened to collapse and the need to prepare for it, and their partner doesn't want to hear anything about it and is, you know, terrified or angry or is pushing back in some way against that. And the person really needs support and direction for how to proceed. Another situation is where a person may have lost their job or no longer want to do the job that they're doing anymore because they really feel a need to give their gifts elsewhere. And so maybe they're wanting some support and guidance in reinventing themselves. Other situations might be the one that you just talked about personally with relocating. You know, I need to relocate somewhere, and I don't know where that place might be that's best for me. So those are some examples.
Well, you know, now that Dear Abby's passed away, I'd love to hear you do your own radio show. I'm picturing a call-in show with advice for hard times and ways to better times. And I know you're super busy already, and we have talked about this a little bit, but I'm looking forward to the day when I can download your podcast or listen to you on the air.
Well, I would love to do it, too. And I am definitely consciously working to move in that direction. And speaking of podcasts, I do have several at my website, carolynbaker.net. Some are free, some are very reasonably priced, but I see a radio show in my future.
And what about your daily sheet of headlines? Tell us about that.
Thank you for asking. The Daily News Digest is published 7 days a week unless I'm traveling. This is a unique service because not only does it provide carefully selected and bundled news pertaining to collapse, but it also provides extensive options for dealing with the news that you're reading. In the options section, you'll find a lot of good news about how people all over the world are dealing with the challenges of our time. So to learn more about subscribing, visit carolynbaker.net and click on the subscription tab.
Okay, well, I'm going to put links to Carolyn's work in my show blog at ecoshock.info. But you can find the hub of all that, as she says, at carolynbaker.net. I am a subscriber. Carolyn, thank you so much for your help.
Well, you're very welcome. Thank you for having me on your show.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Hope of an easy retirement, the new home, their children's education, everything was gone.
Millions of people are balanced on the knife edge of poverty. You know the rich are literally growing richer while the poor get poorer. In every developed country, there are millions of people who are just one paycheck away from financial disaster. I'm concerned about those people. You may be one of them without really thinking about it. And even if you're not, if crowds of people get kicked out on the street, can't afford groceries, or turn to crime to get by, that is certainly going to affect all of our lives. Last week we mentioned Nicole Foss of the Automatic Earth blog. She started out thinking peak oil would collapse the economy, and then wondered if climate change might bring a crash first. Now she's traveling to many countries giving lectures saying the economy itself will crash, even without a push by high energy prices or climate disruption. Nicole is looking at the very big picture, where governments in the United States, the UK, and the rest of Europe are printing billions of dollars out of thin air, like there's no tomorrow. Just a push of a computer button, and $40 billion a month goes to the five biggest American banks to buy up their worst loans. And that's just a fraction of the real support for industrial civilization being billed to some future taxpayers. Let's talk about seniors for a minute. In Canada, payroll taxes are deducted for something called the Canada Pension Plan. That money was actually set aside in a pool which can become huge over the years. The money is really there, unless there's a global crash where everything is worth nothing. In the United States, the government also deducts payroll taxes, but never did save that money. They rolled it into general revenues and spent it on crazy things like foreign wars and oil subsidies. The money isn't there to support American seniors. You've heard of unfunded liabilities. Well, that's one for sure. The other scam in the U.S., but also in Canada and the U.K., is to hide real unemployment numbers by herding people of all ages back into school, allegedly to improve their job prospects and eventual salaries. Student loans in the United States have now topped $1 trillion. Of this, about 15% of loans are already delinquent. Bankers expect that at least $200 billion of student loans will never be repaid. This education bubble is approaching the crazy levels set by the subprime mortgage crisis of 2007-2008, except those loans at least had a house attached, while student loans have no equity. The banks don't need to worry. The federal government guarantees all those loans. The banks can loan out billions at low interest rates, and the taxpayer is on the hook. You can see how that happens. A person 30 or 40 years old, a good worker, is suddenly out of a job. Their job has been automated or sent overseas. Counselors and the media say, well, you have to go back to university to get retrained for another job. Anyway, getting tens of thousands of loans will pay for the mortgage and the groceries while they figure out what to do. Most do not find work in the field they are trained for. Many will end up as waiters or low-paying jobs unable to repay the loans. Even so, the government can garnish their pitiful wages because there is not a way to discharge a student loan through declaring bankruptcy in the United States. It is far worse for youth in Europe and America. When we count inflation, American college students are borrowing almost twice as much as they did just 10 years ago. Here's one quote. According to FICO, while the delinquency rate is climbing, the average amount of student loan debt is increasing even faster. In 2005, the average U.S. student loan debt was $17,233. By 2012, it had ballooned to more than $27,253, an increase of 58% in 7 years. Keep in mind, 1% of the U.S. population has student loans worth over $100,000. More than half of graduate students in one survey said they intended to move back in with their parents after finishing university. University is where youth hang out when there are no jobs for them. Most of the supposed job growth has been for people over the age of 45. I won't even go into the rates of youth unemployment in countries like Italy, Spain, and even France. Probably one quarter of people in those countries will never have a full-time, good-paying job. Meanwhile, millions and millions of people in America, Canada, and the UK are really, really broke. They still watch TV ads for expensive pickup trucks. They may even buy a Starbucks every day. But a rude awakening could be just around the corner with something as simple as a 1% increase in interest rates or a collapse of the unreal prices for stocks these days. At some point in the year, 77% of all Americans are living paycheck to paycheck. One-third of Americans are contributing absolutely nothing to retirement savings. They can't. There is nothing to spare. One survey found that 28% of Americans have nothing at all in savings for emergencies. Another survey found 40% of Americans have $500 or less in savings. 40% have less than $500. In Canada, almost half of Canadians are living paycheck to paycheck. 47% of Canucks are in big trouble if their paycheck is delayed even by a week, and that's actually an improvement. It was 57% in 2011. As the Canadian government has warned its people, Canadians hold record amounts of personal debt in 2012. Total average debt, not including a mortgage, is around $27,000. Those levels are rising rapidly as Canadians keep spending on consumer items bought with credit cards or lines of credit on their houses. They are spending more than their income every year. The household debt-to-income ratio stood at a whopping 164.6%. The average household debt is $103,000, and their total debt is $1.6 trillion. Now I ask you, is that going to end well? Do I need to tell you how bad it is for some of the lower-income people in the UK? In December 2012, the Independent newspaper reported 1 in 10 families were forced to default on their household bills. 1 in 10. 10 million families are in danger, struggling on the edge of that knife edge where a missed paycheck or sudden expense just breaks them. Millions of families are already behind in their utility bills or home payments. You would think Australians are doing much better. In some senses, buoyed by mineral exports, well, they are. But the average Australian has the highest household debt compared to disposable income, higher than anywhere else in the world. They are absolute leaders in the amount of credit card debt. The average Australian owes the equivalent of $56,000, while Americans themselves average out at $44,000. Just recently, Australians started spending more than their total gross domestic product. Of course, many are counting on their high property values as a piggy bank. But what if the market goes down? All of these people in all of these countries have been sold on the middle class dream as a route to becoming really wealthy. They want to live it right now, even if the paycheck isn't there to support it. If that bubble bursts, and simple common sense says the pyramid scheme must fall eventually, it may fall at the top with bankrupt governments and big banks, or it may fall at the bottom with huge crowds of disappointed and, yes, even hungry people in the former first world countries. It could break at the top and the bottom at the same time. Either way, the old system is primed for failure.
United will never be defeated!
Angry voices and marching feet. The last thing a government facing a financial crisis wants to have to deal with.
One future we could see is civil unrest, as we've seen in North Africa. I mean crowds in the street, looting, a breakdown in social services, and then government. I'm not talking about this year, but within the next 10 years, yes, I think so. We all need to think about how we would supplement our food and fuel supplies if the normal money breaks down. We need to organize local communities now that can function even during a breakdown. We need to begin helping one another right now with even more food banks, barter systems, volunteer times, local currencies, markets for locally grown food. I ask you to reach out to those on the edge with comfort and help. I'm not preaching from some safe place for myself. Our major breadwinner was out of work for 10 months just recently. My son-in-law was laid off, but fortunately found a good job a few months later. My own small pension was cut in half. But we've stayed out of the consumer dream for years. Our home is graced with used furniture, our closets with some used clothes. We save what little we have, and we spend less than that. We've lived poorer before. We know how to grow food, chickens, and all that. We know how to heat with wood. But most important of all, we know how to link up with others to trade and enrich our lives with homemade music, child care exchanges, and all the good things community can bring. Watch out for the coming tsunami of poverty. But instead of digging a bunker for food, dig a lot of big holes, to plant food all over your neighborhood and town. Prepare in the big sense of the word. What's coming up on Radio EcoShock? I'm putting together a program on African-American food and farming in the Deep South. It's an unreported scene, and we can all learn a lot from that past and present. My next show in development is about growing food indoors under lights. I'll be talking with two entrepreneurs who are doing it right now, and I might let loose a little of my own experience of growing indoors. Food is the key to our future, and maybe this is one way to get city people started learning what they need to know.
Everybody's talking about local agriculture and trying to create a new food system, but we think that the key is teaching people how to begin growing their own food, because that's how you make it personal. That's how you make people care about food. Once they stick their fingers in the dirt and they see a lettuce grow or tomato grow from a seed, all of a sudden they begin to take it personally. They care about it. You know, they say, wow.
If you have suggestions or tips, please send them along to radio@ecoshock.org. My special thanks to listeners who donated this past week. Your generosity makes it all worthwhile. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. A couple of weeks ago, I managed to squeeze in a clip from a song by Kukulkan called Mother Earth. Then my blog got chopped off, and they didn't get the link they deserved. Well, this week I'm going to play you the whole thing and link to the band in my blog at ecoshock.info. Thank you for sending me that song, guys.
Oh, Mother Nature, oh, Mother Earth, mankind ain't been so kind to you. Oh, Mother Nature, oh, Mother Earth, I can hear you crying. Deforestation, industrialization has taken a toll on you. Ice caps are melting, changing ocean currents, and the weather in the sky. Oh, Mother Nature, oh, Mother Earth, I can hear you crying. Coal and oil taken from below, gold and silver taken from your soul. I can hear you crying. Deforestation, industrialization has taken a toll on you. Ice caps are melting, changing ocean currents, and the weather in the sky. Oh, Mother Nature, oh, Mother Earth, I can hear you crying. Cold and oil taken from below, gold and silver taken from your soul. Hail to your mountains and valleys. Hail to your forest and the sea.
To the earth. done to you.